You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Before we start, I have a couple of housekeeping notes. The Second City has gone from stage to screen and really everything in between. Our live shows in Chicago will be resuming on May 7th with limited capacity in our main stage theater. Look for our other stages to open up in the coming weeks and months. We're also resuming some live in-person classes, corporate shows, and learning sessions. We continue to have virtual offerings in all these areas, as well as hybrid offerings. You can get all the information you need at secondcity.com.
Welcome to the world of Tony Ho from CBC Podcasts. It's an award-winning, bite-sized narrative comedy series about human relationships, familiar, hilarious, and sometimes unnerving. The troupe features Miguel Rivas, Adam Niebergall, and alumnus of the Second City mainstage, Roger Bainbridge. They will take you on a darkly comedic ride that finds honesty in every situation. You can listen and subscribe to Tony Ho on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, I absolutely adored this human being. Katie Milkman is a professor at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania and holds a secondary appointment at Penn's Perelman School of Medicine. In 2018, she began hosting Charles Schwab's popular podcast, Choiceology, with Katie Milkman, which I listen to all the time. And she's got a new book. It's called How to Change, The Science of Getting from Where You Are to Where You Want to Be. Enjoy this pod. I think you will.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting the Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Katie Milkman, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
In the introduction of your book, you talk about the tennis star Andre Agassi. It's someone who we fondly remember as a superstar, but actually in the mid-1990s, his tennis career was not really going in the right direction. And then he has dinner with Brad Gilbert, who's another tennis person, not a huge star, but, you know, player. Tell us the rest of that story and how it sets up the ideas that you're talking about in How to Change.
Oh, I love that you're letting me tell the story. So most people know Agassi as someone who's a poster boy for tennis. So he was the bad boy of the sport in the 90s.
Killer mullet.
Yeah, exactly. The wild ripped jeans. He wore lipstick to a tournament once, but he never really lived up to expectations. He had all of this natural talent. Everyone told him he was going to be number one in the world. But these other players who he'd gone to tennis academy with, who he'd thought were jokes, they were the ones, Courier, Sampras, who were dominating in the world rankings. And he had this pivotal dinner, as you mentioned, with Brad Gilbert, where Brad let him in on a key secret to the sport that Agassi had been getting wrong. And the secret was really the recipe actually came from a best-selling book Brad Gilbert had just published at the time called Winning Ugly. And it was that if you want to win a tennis match, it's critical to focus on your opponent's weaknesses and to strategize in order to take advantage of them rather than just doing what you normally do. And Gilbert pointed out to Agassi, you're so talented and you're so excellent at going for winners and nailing those shots. You totally neglect your opponent and their weaknesses and never play in the smartest way. Instead, you just go for it because you're so good that you have gotten far on that strategy, but it's the wrong strategy. And if we can just turn you into a strategic player who figures out where's the weakness? How can I exploit it? And plays in a way that's smarter, you'll win more. And of course, you know, after this dinner, Gilbert ends up becoming Agassi's coach, and Agassi ascends to the number one ranking in the world, which he held for 101 weeks in his career. And, you know, there were some more ups and downs, but that was a clear turning point for him. He really figured it out. And the reason I open with this story in the book is actually, well, there's two reasons. One is I was a tennis player as a young person, and so I loved, and I loved Agassi, and telling the story was such fun for me. That's one reason. But there's actually a point to it besides bringing me joy, which is that behavior change is a really similar beast. A lot of us go into it, and a lot of the self-help bestsellers suggest just sort of playing your own game, like just a strategy that's a universal strategy, like set big audacious goals or visualize success. And in fact, what my career, spending 20 years studying the science of behavior change in academia, has taught me is that a much smarter strategy and more effective one is to tailor your approach to your opponent. And of course, your opponent isn't standing across the net from you like they would be in a tennis match, but your opponent is inside your head. Yes. And it's, is it your tendency to be impulsive, to procrastinate? Is it your lack of confidence? Is it your general tendency to take the path of least resistance? And whatever it is, maybe it's forgetting, you can tailor your strategy to tackle that obstacle to change, and you'll be much more successful. So then the book, of course, goes on to lay out what are the most common challenges that stand in the way of change? You know, what does the science say about them, and what can we do to tailor our strategies? What are the tactics that are well suited to overcoming each of those, so that when you face one, you will approach it like a brilliant strategist, like Brad Gilbert would tell you to, instead of, you know, maybe with a one size fits all solution that would do okay, but just isn't as well suited to overcoming your hurdles.
This is what I love about the intersection of behavioral science and improvisation, because, and the people who invented these exercises and games, many of which were in like the 1920s or then when we started in 1959, but the early exercises are all about getting you out of your fear and judgment brain, and all about being purely others focused. And that opens up the world to you in ways that you maybe don't experience otherwise. And what I really enjoyed in your first chapter, which is about the getting started problem, is and I love that, because it is like just getting started is so hard. And you have a Wharton alum who is working HR at Google that you feature in helping them. And this was around employees and wellness, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Prasad Sethi. Well, not just wellness, productivity, you know, financial wellness, as well as health and wellness, just sort of HR problems. Like, how can we help people make better choices about those things that HR worries about all day?
And there was a quote in the book that I took out from here, which was, quote, "Rather than perceiving time as a continuum, we tend to think about our lives in episodes, creating story arcs from the notable incidents or chapters in our lives." So again, this is like, we think we're going in sort of a linear fashion, or that we're getting A, B, and C right, but often we aren't, because, I mean, our memories are terrible anyway, right?
Absolutely. Our memories do the most interesting things to us. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I love that. I love that you pulled out that quote. And I will say, I think that's one of the most interesting things I've learned about human nature, is the way that we reflect on time, and how, instead of sort of really recognizing, well, you know, it's funny because we're talking during the COVID pandemic, and I think people recognize it much more. In the last year, there's been a lot of talk about how it feels like one really long week since this started. And there's a lot more discussion of the stretching and the strange taffy that is time because of what we've all been through. But in general, I think it's something we tend to underappreciate, that time is a construct, and that our memory and the way we think about it shapes our experience in important ways, and it shapes our motivation. It shapes whether or not we pursue our goals, and which is, of course, what the chapter you're referencing is about.
So tell us about the fresh start effect, because that's time-based here.
Yeah, exactly. So the fresh start effect is an effect that leads us to pursue our goals with greater enthusiasm and higher probability at the beginning of what feels like a new chapter in our lives. Mm-hmm. So anytime we enter an era that we mark as a new one, we feel like we have a bit of a clean slate. You know, there's an identity shift that comes with those fresh start moment. So let me give you some examples that might even, some will ring true and you'll say, yeah, like I knew that. And some you'll say, oh, wow, neat. So one is like the beginning of a new year, New Year's resolutions, mm-hmm. right? This is like, oh yeah, of course. At the start of a new year, you feel like you're opening a new year in your life. Last year was the old me. This is the new me. The new me has a clean slate, and whatever the old me couldn't do, maybe I can do it. And that's part of what motivates New Year's resolutions, along with the sort of shared social construct we've created. But then there are other moments that are smaller, like the start of a new week, the celebration of a birthday, even the start of a new month or a celebration of a holiday that feels like a fresh start holiday, like Labor Day. Those moments can also demarcate time. The start of spring is a moment that if you call out to people, they realize it's a fresh start. They're more likely to achieve, to pursue their goals starting mm-hmm. on March 20th. If you just label it for them as the first day of spring, people are more likely to sign up for a 401k program starting on that date, or say they want to start getting reminders about their goals. So all of these moments. And then, of course, an even bigger shift happens if you say move to a new job or move to a new home or become a parent. Then there's an identity shift, an actual change that accompanies just the psychological shift. And that can be an even bigger kind of fresh start. So all of these moments, they feel like new beginnings, and they lead to this big picture thinking and this sense that I have a new, I'm a new person, and the old me's failures aren't with me anymore, so I can do more.
So I was on a panel yesterday, and the question was, how many of you have started like an art project or a big change in your life during this time? And then how many of you have completed it? And we did a poll, and it was 50%. 50% did it, 50% didn't. And I was
50%
one that
completed it, you mean, or 50% started it?
Yeah, I always think it was started it. But I did a thing, I decided I was going to get healthy or as healthy as I possibly can. And I've been reading, I think I had BJ Fogg on talking about some of the habit stuff. And so what I did was I took out my sneakers and my workout clothes and put them on the stairs. And then, so I would work out every morning. And part of that was also, that's when I listen to my favorite podcasts, including yours. You're on that list.
I'm honored.
And that that sounded to me a little bit like what you call in the book temptation bundling.
Absolutely. You are temptation bundling. You're a natural. You've got it. Yeah. So this is actually just like you. It's a technique that I started trying when I was actually a graduate student and I was struggling with two problems. I was finding it difficult to motivate myself at the end of a long day of class. I was an engineering student and the classes were grueling.
Yeah.
And so I'd find it hard at the end of a long day to motivate myself to go to the gym, even though I knew it really did wonders for my stress and productivity when I got those workouts in. And then on the flip side, I also had trouble motivating myself to do my problem sets, because what I really wanted to do when I came home was, you know, curl up with a juicy page turner on the couch, or, you know, pop on Netflix and binge watch TV shows. So I actually came up with a solution to both of my problems, which looks a lot like what you just described, and mm-hmm. it's called temptation bundling. I only let myself enjoy my favorite entertainment. In this case, I turned to audio novels and books mm-hmm. like the Hunger Games trilogy or Harry Potter, you know, the James Cross, the Alex Cross series. And would only let myself listen to the next chapter while I was exercising at the gym. And what this did is it motivated me to go to the gym at the end of a long day, because I wanted to know what happened next in my latest novel. And time flew while I was there. It was fun. And then simultaneously, I stopped wasting time at home on this entertainment, because I was going to get to do it at the gym. I'd feel energized. I'd come home from that workout and I'd get my work done. So it was this magic solution for me. And I realized, oh, I could study this. It might help other people. So I've since done research proving I am not alone, that other people can use this technique, that it can increase exercise if you give people the opportunity to combine something they really enjoy, like an audio novel that's tempting, with workouts. And I've seen it applied in lots of other settings too. It can help kids actually persist longer. Research by Ayel at Fishbach at the University of Chicago and Caitlin Woolley at Cornell showed that when kids in school are given markers and snacks and fun music to listen to while they work on math worksheets, contrary to the expectation of their worried teachers, actually are more productive and more persistent because it's fun. They're enjoying the activity. So when you bundle things that you enjoy, it makes you more excited to be doing what you're doing, and you're more successful.
I've worked in theater my entire life, so I tie things back to that. But knowing that the origins of theater were to show human beings back to themselves, when you think about Temptation, Bubbling Cues, Fresh Start, I think of cues. I think of opening nights. I think of all the rituals and rites that exist in theater. And I think of like the way the importance of self-talk, right? Like, so I was talking to Allison Wood Brooks at one point, and this was years ago, and I was getting a lot of speaking dates, and I go, you know, I actually get nervous before speaking dates. They always turn out fine, but I wish at the top I wouldn't. She goes, well, you should say out loud you're excited. And so literally my wife and I do this like all the time, and I've given the advice to other people and they're like, it works. If I say it, just it's channeling that stress.
That makes me so happy. Do you know I was on Allison Woodbrook's dissertation committee and that was her dissertation work?
Oh no, it was?
So that just makes me extra happy because it brings me back. So yes.
It found its way back into a useful, I use it all the time and I tell people and it is.
It's and brilliant.
It shouldn't surprise us. These are the way we grew as a species was with this stuff. Okay, the other thing is when I'm talking about creativity and that, what I often say to people is what many people don't understand about people in the creative arts is constraints are their friends. You give a bunch of constraints and they can do incredible things. And when you don't, they don't. There's just no boundaries. Talk about opting into constraints. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Although, okay. First, I just want to note that one of my favorite studies that I've ever seen, and I can't give you a citation for this. All I can tell you is I saw a poster about it maybe a decade ago, and it has captured my imagination ever since, was the study done that involved knitting, and different groups of people were given different knitting equipment. Some were given lots of colors and some were given two. Then they were told to knit the most creative scarf they could. And then independent raters judged the creativity of the scarves knitted by the randomly assigned groups, some of whom got lots of colors, all the colors of the rainbow, and others got two. And the people who got two colors, their scarves were dramatically more creative.
Wow.
And I just thought it was so fascinating. It's such a nice illustration of what you just said. It's not in my book, but I just wanted to.
No, that's a good one, though. I like it.
It's a really neat study. I wish I could tell you more than it was a poster at the Society for Judgment and Decision Making annual meeting sometime in the last decade. Okay, so let me get to your question about constraints and how they can be helpful. So most of the time, economists think constraints are bad. People want more freedom, more choices. That's good. Sometimes policymakers have to be thoughtful about human limitations and put constraints and rules on to make sure we don't make bad decisions. Like heroin will be illegal, for instance, or I'm going to ban you from playing music that's too loud so that it interferes with your neighbors, or I'll ban driving above a certain speed because you could get in an accident or hit someone else. Okay, so we recognize there's a need for someone to be able to put limits, bans, restrictions, fines on certain behaviors. What's interesting, though, is that sometimes we can benefit from putting those restrictions and bans on ourselves, and we'll even have a taste for it. And those are in situations where we recognize we're going to face a temptation, and that having some boundaries that will keep us from indulging when it would be bad for us, or procrastinating on something that we might put off indefinitely, can be really, really beneficial. We could recognize that about our future self. And economists call it sophistication, when people recognize this about themselves and then set up constraints. So examples that can give you a sense of this. There's a study I love by Dan Ariely and Klaus Wartenbrock from about 20 years ago. It's now a classic, showing that students given the opportunity to self-impose deadlines when they have three papers due in a class, many students will choose to self-impose deadlines with penalties that are equidistant roughly, instead of leaving themselves flexibility to turn all of the papers in on the last day of the class. And that having the ability to give yourself those deadlines with penalties that aren't all lumped at the end of the term improves your performance. And of course, better yet is when this instructor forces them on you, but people can recognize the benefits themselves and set up those kinds of restrictions. Another example is that if you give people access to a bank account, that they can put money into that they won't be allowed to withdraw until a certain date is reached that they choose, or a certain savings goal. Research by Nava Ashraf, Dean Carlin, and Wesley Yen, three talented economists, has shown that you can actually see people save about 80% more year over year. Just access to that locked bank account, essentially. And it doesn't have a higher interest rate. And these folks have access to a regular bank account too. But compared to another group that only has access to a regular account where withdrawing anytime is fine, that constrained account helps people resist temptation to dip into their savings. So these are just a few examples of ways that constraints can be effective. And let me stop there and see if you want to dig into other topics or have me go further on that.
No, I mean, there's those apps that will donate money to a cause that you hate, right?
Yes.
That's one of my favorite ones.
Yes, I love that. So the, another way you can impose constraints on yourself is through what I call cash commitment devices. This is where instead of like a deadline or an account you can't access, you literally fine yourself if you don't do the thing you want to do. So there's this website actually created by behavioral economists called STICK, STICKK. The second K is for contract. That's like what a lawyer, anyway, lawyers think contracts start with K. That's their acronym, or that's their abbreviation for it. So on STICK, you can set a goal, put money on the line that you'll forfeit if you fail to achieve it, and you can give it to a anti-charity, like, you know, the opposite political party or some group that takes a strong stand on something you care about, like gun control versus gun rights, so that it'll really hurt if you have to give that money up. And then you declare a referee who will report to the site. And it can also sometimes be a device on whether or not you've achieved that goal, whether it's, you know, trying to hit the gym a certain number of times in the next week, or, finish several of your Duolingo lessons on a foreign language, or, you know, getting to church, whatever it is that you want to do. You can use that kind of a tool to restrict your likelihood of going off the rails, because now there's a penalty and it's a larger cost if you don't follow through.
This is the level of nerd I've become in my life, is that I got very excited that Max Bazerman was your advisor in college.
You are a nerd.
Yes.
Not college. He was my PhD advisor. PhD. Yes. PhD. Yes. I'm so lucky. He is absolutely wonderful.
Well, and that's also nice to know that someone that brilliant is also seemingly kind, right? And
not seemingly, absolutely.
Absolutely kind. Yeah. Right. And this chapter on confidence, I found really, really fascinating. And I actually used a passage from here with a colleague the other day. Who was kind of struggling with a person she was getting to know, and I said, you should ask that person for advice. And the way that and I want you to talk about while you talk about it, the way I thought about it is, it's a wonderful way to give up your status, and I think most people aren't aware. A lot of people aren't aware that they have the status they have. And other people are just opened up when they're sort of allowed to, you know, exist in the same space with that person and not feel smaller than them.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you nailed it. That's such a brilliant application of it. And it's great interpersonal advice. So the way I write about it in the book is in the context of this obstacle to change, which is not believing you can do it and lacking confidence. And it sounds like maybe that can also be an interpersonal barrier, right? You're interacting with someone and there's a tension because they feel like you're maybe they're the less confident party in the relationship. Mm-hmm. They need some status boost, some ego boost. So Lauren Eskris Winkler, who is a PhD student at the University of Pennsylvania under my close friend and collaborator, Angela Duckworth, had this brilliant insight when she was studying grit. And she was trying to figure out what creates gritty people who achieve their goals. And she realized that she's interviewing all these people, you know, she's interviewing salespeople and students and just regular everyday sort of people trying to achieve their goals, like get fit or quit smoking. And people who were struggling had great advice when she asked them, like, what do you think would work? And she realized so often when we meet someone who's struggling to achieve their goals, we make the assumption that they don't have the knowledge they need. And we start like giving them advice about what they should do. But often it is inside them. They just don't have the confidence to do it. And she wondered if we have the script wrong and we should flip it. If instead of peppering them with our, you know, suggestions. We should ask them if they'd consider being a role model to someone else and sharing their wisdom with peers. So what she realized that would do is boost people's confidence that, hey, somebody thinks I'm worthy of being put on a pedestal. Maybe I've got what it takes to achieve more. And second, it would cause some introspection to happen that might be really valuable. When you think about what could work for you, you're going to come up with tailored solutions. You might have an insight that you wouldn't have had if you weren't asked to think about how to put that into words for someone else. And then once you say something and give someone else advice, there's something called the saying is believing effect in psychology, where it's going to feel sort of hypocritical not to do the thing you told someone else to do. So you may be more likely to act on that. And so all those things together can combine to help people achieve more when they're prompted to give advice. And Lauren has done a bunch of studies on this. One I got to collaborate on with her and a few other co-authors involved a random assignment study of almost 2,000 high school students. Some of them at the beginning of the term were encouraged to just write some advice on study tips that would help them be more effective in school, and others weren't. And they spent about 10 minutes answering some questions about how to study more effectively. And that turned out to boost their grades in that quarter of the year significantly, both in math and a subject they had identified as the one they most wanted to improve in relative to a control group that was otherwise identical, just didn't get this opportunity to give advice to peers about study habits. So, you know, it didn't turn C students into valedictorians. They were very small changes because it was a very small intervention, but it was significant. And that's sort of, I think, really exciting and suggests just one way that we can use this insight to help people.
There's another aspect in this chapter, which reminds me of when people talk about trying to keep a beginner's mind when they come in. And it's the story about George Danzig. The Berkeley Math. Can you tell this? This is a great story.
I love this story. I do. It's such a wonderful story. So he was a graduate student at Berkeley. I don't remember if he was in math or statistics, but he was late to class one day. And there were some problems up on the board when he walked in late, and he jotted them down in his notebook. And he assumed they were homework problems, and they seemed a little harder than usual. But, you know, he worked them out. He worked through them, and he came back with solutions and turned them in. Apparently, a few days later, the professor who had put those problems on the board came and found him and said, "Oh my God, George, these were unsolvable math problems and you solved them." And the sort of punchline of the story is that because he believed they were solvable, he just thought they were homework problems, he approached them with the mindset that this was doable. And so he was able to make progress that others hadn't achieved. Perhaps, you know, it's an anecdote. So perhaps because, I mean, maybe it was just because he was brilliant and he would have solved them no matter what. But that belief that they were solvable probably made a difference.
I've told this story before on the podcast, but it reminded me of I was at Stanford. My wife and I were co-lecturing for a graduate school class. And I met up with Tina Seelig because I'd had her on the podcast and we hit it off and we were having coffee. And she was working on a project around luck. And Anne goes, "Oh, well, you know, Kelly is incredibly lucky. Like, he's the luckiest person for finding parking spaces." And then Tina's observation was, "I don't know that it's Kelly's lucky that there's parking spaces. It's that he assumes there's parking spaces for him. So he sees the ones that are there." And I think that's kind of a similar thing of like, hey, well, no, let's assume a good thing is going to happen, and then you might allow a good thing to happen.
Yeah, no, absolutely. If you're confident, you take charge in situations, you persist longer, you try things you might not try, and it can have really big benefits. And so I think that's an important lesson. And the way I'm thinking about it in the book is, okay, once we know that, then what are the things we can do with that insight? How can we help other people around us build that kind of confidence by showing them we believe in them? And how can we instill confidence in ourselves? And maybe by surrounding ourselves with others who believe in us, putting ourselves in positions where we can be role models and give advice to others and so on.
So I'm going to ask you for a yes and story in a second, but I do want to cover this one last topic. So when I'm talking about improvisation and its power to transform individuals and groups and all that, one of the things I say all the time is, you don't go to a gym once and you're done. And so the idea that you're going to solve your culture and communication problems with 1 3-hour improv workshop is bullshit. You should be doing this stuff regularly. And you kind of cover that when you talk to Dr. Kevin Volpe who says, quote, "When we diagnose someone with diabetes, we don't put them on insulin for a month, take them off and expect them to be cured." This is a practice, right? I mean, this is a skill that it changes, is a skill that has to be practiced and kept at.
Absolutely. And I think, honestly, I will admit that I had the wrong belief set when I came to studying this topic too. I was sort of on the hunt for some fantasy cure that would, where we could put someone through a program for 4 weeks and suddenly, boom, they would come out the other end with lasting gym habits and, you know, done with overeating for the rest of their lives, or, you know, pick your goal. They'd be the most productive person you've ever seen, that magically we could change people's habits in a way that would just endure forever. And, you know, there's some ways that we can build some good habits. There's a chapter in the book on that. But, mm-hmm. But for the most part, what the research suggests, and even the research on habit, is you can make some progress that lasts, but it drops off a lot when you stop using the tactics or the programming that's gotten you started. And so what that led me to appreciate is, well, why are we doing things where we just put in that first burst of energy or do a short program? We should just look for solutions and tactics that we can continually use instead mm-hmm. of things that are short term, and treat these challenges as just like a chronic disease. That's a very negative framing, but doesn't have to be that negative, because, for instance, we talked about temptation bundling, right? Tying mm-hmm. exercise with something that you love so that you look forward to it. That's not depressing at all to do for the rest of your life, but it's very doable. But the moment you stop, you're going to stop enjoying your workouts and you're going to stop exercising. So if the mindset is that these things only endure so long as you keep doing what's working and keep solving for whatever obstacle is in your path, then I think we can get a lot farther rather than looking for a miracle one-time solution.
Yeah, 100%. All right. We always end the podcast by asking our guests for a yes and story. So in parlance of improvisation, when two people are making something out of nothing, they can't get nowhere by saying no, and actually don't get very far by saying yes. You say yes and, you affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. Do you have a yes and story for us?
My yes and story is that in the summer of 2016, I was sitting at a computer next to a new friend, another academic, Angela Duckworth, who bestselling author of Grit, and we were both really interested in what created durable behavior change and frustrated by how little we knew. And we'd been talking about it. We're sitting at the computer, sort of looking at papers together, talking about what we might work on. And this email flies up, and it's from the president of our university. We're both professors at the University of Pennsylvania. And she says, "The MacArthur Foundation has announced a $100 million prize that will go to a team that's prepared to solve a major social problem. And the University of Pennsylvania is going to have an internal competition to see what team we're going to advance. And we want all of you to send your best ideas." And Angela looked at me and I looked at her, and she said, "Let's submit something about creating a solution that changes behavior in a truly durable way. Let's try to figure out the answer. Let's spend, let's get $100 million grant to do it." And I said, yes. Uh-huh. And we didn't get it, but we spent a huge amount. We won the competition at the University of Pennsylvania, beat out 43 other teams with an idea we developed that we thought would really supercharge the science of behavior change. We made it to the round of 200 of thousands of submissions, and then not to the round of 8. But by then we were on our way, and we ended up getting seed funding from other sources, starting a center that looks at the science of durable behavior change. It's what kickstarted me on the work that actually led me to write this book. So saying yes to that completely crazy proposal that we go after a $100 million grant, which thank goodness we didn't get it, because I don't know how I would have dealt with that much responsibility. It was a wonderful adventure.
The book is called How to Change, The Science of Getting from Where You Are to Where You Want to Be. Katie Milkman, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. This was really fun.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is LF Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
world.
Survive.